morning, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. Michael Wertheimer for the Attorney General's Office and for the Connecticut parties in this case. The Connecticut Attorney General's Office, I'm sorry. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please. We are here to ask the court to reverse the FERC's decision in this case as arbitrary and capricious and remand it to the FERC for a hearing concerning the justice and reasonableness of ISO New England's executive compensation. FERC's decisions must reflect, with respect to rates, no question they have broad discretion, but it's not unlimited discretion. And their decisions must reflect reasoned decision-making and respond to the particular concerns raised in the case. With regard to executive compensation in this case, the FERC's decisions did none of those things. Executive compensation is an element of the utility's rates, just like any other element. Just like gas costs, pension, depreciation, they go up and down, and a rate that may be considered just and reasonable in one rate case is not necessarily just and reasonable in the next. That's why you have the FERC to review rates and make the findings that the rates are reasonable, but no more than are at levels that are no more than just and reasonable.
What would be reasonable compensation for, I guess it's these 12 or 11 executives? And we have in the record what they were paid, what their base salary was.
And well, actually, thank you, Your Honor. Actually, you don't have in the record. The first problem that we had and that we raised in this case was that ISO New England never disclosed what it intended to pay as executive.
It dealt with a range.
But then it.
Excuse me?
Gave a range.
It did not give a range.
Initially, what did it give? There wasn't something there?
It was nothing there in their initial application.
What are you complaining about that? It can't be unreasonable if it doesn't exist. It gave a range, didn't it, Kevin?
It is there. No, the initial application was blank with respect to executive compensation.
But then they filled it in.
It was not approved in that standard.
Subsequently, they amended with a study. Now, the study was 2 years old. The study. First of all, with the study, they said that they did not disclose what the executive compensation was. All they said in the transmittal letter was that it would be reasonable to presume that the executive compensation would be consistent with the levels reflected in the study. Now, the study was based on 2007 data, and the rate year is 2009. Now, the study was based on a proxy group, and which is, to answer your question, Your Honor.
2008.
The study was submitted in 2008 to ISO New England in March of 2008 based on 2007 actual data.
Yeah. Is that not inevitable?
Clearly there's a lag. Clearly there's a lag, but that does not, make it just and reasonable in this case for two reasons.
It doesn't make it unjust and unreasonable either.
No. In this case, we submit it does for two reasons. First of all, the proxy group, and to answer your question directly, you determine reasonableness, generally speaking, in the utility regulation by proxy groups, looking at comparable companies, what they are doing, but also considering prevailing economic and regulatory priorities.
So what would be the maximum salary that you think is reasonable for the CEO?
The CEO should be paid, in our view, levels of executive compensation that are comparable to utilities, not-for-profit entities, regulated utilities that have roughly the same revenue levels as ISO New England.
What would that
now, ISO New England's annual revenues, I'm not prepared, and we don't set the rates. But, Your Honor, the proxy group, ISO New England has annual revenues of 128.
That's unreasonable when you can't give us any numbers.
The numbers were never debated on the record in this case, Your Honor. The proxy group, for ISO New England has annual revenues of $128 million. The proxy group in the study was entities that were both utilities and non-utilities, not-for-profit and for-profit companies of entities with $3 billion to $5 billion in annual revenues. Of course, those executive compensation levels are going to be far higher. Those entities are much larger, have much more significant financial risk, and their compensation reflects that risk. Our position was that it was unreasonable for the FERC to presume that
the study also point out that the actual handle involved in the settlements as well as the revenue stream here is a great deal bigger than the raw revenue stream alone.
It did. But, Your Honor, the difference between the size of a company that is 20 to 40 times bigger does not make it doesn't matter. The prevailing the countervailing
issue. You're saying that the total handle in terms of inclusion of the settlements as well as the stream doesn't matter?
The settlements is just what they do day to day. They run a company, an entity that has $128 million in annual revenue. Mm-hmm. They're not GM. They're not Ford. Another difference, Your Honor,
they didn't use GM and Ford in the proxy agreement.
No, they didn't. But they did use for-profit, non-utility companies. And the difference there is significant.
Is it not reasonable to assume that in the hiring market they would have to be competitive with some companies that were for-profit companies?
Yes, okay. But of the same size and of the same class, not 20 to 40 times larger than that.
That 20 to 40 times computation, though, is just based on revenue stream, right?
It is, Your Honor. But that is generally how executive...
I thought you agreed that the consultants used other items besides revenue stream.
They did. They used others, but that doesn't... But that they also did disregarded others. They disregarded the fact that utilities are guaranteed a revenue stream. They don't have to... By the fact that they have ratepayers that are going to pay their rates, they're going to be paid. They're going to collect their revenues. Non-utility for-profit entities have a much more significant market risk, have to pay their shareholders dividends, and that makes a much higher risk, and for that they are provided more in their executive compensation, and reasonably so. But that is a countervailing factor to the fact that ISO New England, they do handle settlements, but they're market makers. They make a market. That's just what they do day to day. The risk of the company is generally runs in direct correlation with the level of executive compensation.
You agree that what the ISO does is very important?
No question. But every company, the corner drugstore, what they do is very important,
too. Very important for the consumers of Connecticut, for everyone in Connecticut.
Oh, absolutely. And
right,
throughout New
England? You want good people to be running it.
Right. But the FERC has an obligation to determine how much is just and reasonable, but not more than just and reasonable. Our contention is that this study, which was based on data, I'm sorry for the similarity in words there, didn't determine what level. I mean, yes, it's important,
Without the market crash or the economic crash, would this have been just and reasonable?
Without the market crash, we would have had far fewer legs to stand on with this.
So it's really a change in the overall economic picture.
Absolutely. The study was done based on 2007 data. The market crashed. Then ISO New England submits its application to the FERC, and FERC uses the old data as reasonable. Now, executive compensation that may have been just and reasonable before the economic crash was not, in our view, necessarily just and reasonable after the economic crash. Many executives took less pay, reflective of the change in economic circumstances.
So is your problem here with the proxy group? I thought you were arguing that the proxy group itself was inappropriate, but it seems to be just that the timing of the study is what you're objecting to.
There are two fundamental problems with the FERC's reliance on the study. One was that the proxy group was inherently unreliable. That's why we argued that we were entitled to a hearing, because the credibility or the reliability of the proxy group on which they relied was unreasonable, and that is grounds for a hearing in this case. FERC denied that. The second ground that the report is unreasonable is that circumstances economically changed dramatically. Now, this is a point that FERC just got wrong in its decision on rehearing. They indicated, I believe it's paragraph 22, that the ISO based its application on circumstances that existed at the time of the application, suggesting that the market crashed after they submitted their application, there's nothing that they can do about it. But when you look at the timing of it, that's just not the case. Their application was submitted on October 31st. The amendment to the application, on which FERC completely relies, was submitted December 8th. And as you know, the market crash was mid-September, I believe September 15th is what they call the Black Monday, where Lehman Brothers collapsed and the stock market plummeted. So the timing...
The last crash before yesterday.
It crashed before ISO's application.
Before yesterday.
But you also said there would always...
Exactly. That may have been just a mistake that I said.
You also said there would always be a lag, and that seems reasonable. I mean, in other words, you would always be looking backwards to find the comparisons.
Right. There's a for the data. But again, FERC has an independent obligation as a regulator that sets rates to make sure that the rates it approves are just and reasonable based on the best information that it has at the time it makes that decision. Now, it made that decision at the end of December, which is after economic conditions change. During rate cases for utilities, it is very common for, as economic conditions change, for the record to be updated, for the decisions to move, because things, the targets can move. I understand that the FERC does the best it can to set rates at the time it issues its decision. But our contention is that it was arbitrary and capricious for the FERC to rely completely on this study to set rates when the study has the two flaws that Your Honor identified, based on an unreasonable proxy group and was dated at the time. And the third flaw was that ISO never disclosed exactly what it proposed to pay for executive compensation. It wasn't in the application.
Again,
counsel, it wasn't.
There again, counsel, you, in your brief, say that on October 31, 2008, let me see if I can find it again. Anyhow, you say in there that they did disclose the approximate, though not exact, salary.
In the study.
That's what I was referring to as a range. You were disputing me on it in oral, but in your brief, you admit precisely that.
The study has, no, I don't mean to mislead you. I appreciate the clarification. The study did provide a range of reasonableness. Mm-hmm. And in the ISO's transmittal letter, just to be clear, they said that they would not identify the executive compensation, only that it's reasonable to presume that it would be consistent with that range.
Yeah.
So there's two steps that are very, you're in the ballpark, but you don't know what it is.
Is it not the case that many of the things, and this is a necessarily prospective accounting for judging the just and reasonableness of the rates based upon which we based upon all of these items. I mean, there's a necessary prospective element to this accounting. So it's not. It is not the norm that we know precisely what those figures are going to be, is it?
You know at the time that you set rates what you should know. This is what we're paying now, and then you just know that things are going to go up and down till the next case where you reset it, but you do the best you can when you set rates to get it all right at that time. That is FERC's obligation under the Federal Power Act.
Is FERC entitled to rely at all on the fact that there was an independent board of directors and who looked at the range and then an outside consulting firm? In other words, it wasn't just the CEO setting his or her own salary.
Understood. That is one element that the FERC certainly can and should consider when considering the rates, but that is from the applicant. The board of directors of the applicant said that they considered that level reasonable, and that is fine. But
is
FERC, FERC does not delegate its rate making.
Sure, it doesn't delegate it, but it would seem to be two relevant factors would be that there was an independent board of directors. I don't think there's any allegation that the board was somehow.
No. Agreed,
problematic, and then an outside consulting firm that you may disagree with what they did, but it is an outside firm that has a reputation. And
in this case,
relies on that.
Sure, it is fair to look at, but the independent board of directors also relied upon this Mercer report, which we contend was flawed, which we contend was dated by the time, and what we and the crux of our complaint, Your Honor, is that we never got a hearing on this. We think that there were enough questions raised.
You know that it's not uncommon for FERC to decide matters on the paper filings without a trial-type hearing.
We know that very well, Your Honor.
We would be very loath to create a precedent saying they can't do it that way.
No, and I'm not asking you to, but you have recognized in many cases, and FERC has recognized in many cases, that there are circumstances in which hearings are necessary and appropriate. And those circumstances are when the credibility, one of those circumstances, when the credibility of the evidence upon which it's relying has been called into question. We believe that we did that in this case, Your Honor. We questioned the credibility of the Mercer report in the two respects that I discussed with Judge Brown. And the FERC did not, in its final decision on rehearing, did not substantively address those questions. It did not go in to explain, we understand, it would have been one thing if the FERC said, we understand the questions about the proxy group, but here's why we looked at it, here's why we, they didn't say anything. All they said was that we're not convinced that it's not just and reasonable. And then the second point, with respect to the timing, all the FERC said in this decision on rehearing was that they went to the low end. We understand their economic factors, but they went to the low end of the range. Well, the low end of an unreasonable range is still unreasonable in our view. And then they made the statement that ISO relied on the evidence at the time it presented its application, which we submit is clearly not true.
Do you know if the IRS has changed since 2008 what it considers reasonable for pay for nonprofits?
I do not know. Okay. You raise a good point that the study was done for IRS purposes, but that I do not know. But I do know that regulators in the utility world, where I live, have changed their view of what appropriate executive compensation is based on what the economy is doing, just as shareholders demand of the executives of any publicly held corporation.
Well, you say that, ISO never actually said what the salaries were going to be. They suggested a range. Are they obligated by any law or regulation to actually disclose salaries?
They're not that I'm aware of, Your Honor, but they are obligated to carry the burden of in their rate application of showing that their rates are just and reasonable.
For I'm not sure if there's not a faith leap there that's a little difficult to make, to go from they're obligated to show just and reasonable to get to they have to show exact dollars for executive per executive.
They don't.
As long as they show a reasonable range, not saying you have to concede this case,
right,
but as a theoretical proposition, would it not be possible to achieve just and reasonable rates based on a reasonable range without having a dollar-for-dollar accounting?
It depends on the range, Your Honor. If it's a narrow range, I could certainly understand that. In this case, the range was based on a study that we believe is flawed and is not comparable. But the way rates are set is that it's a snapshot in time. As of this date, this is what you're going to be paid because you're collecting that money from ratepayers. There has to be a bottom line to the penny that can then be billed to ratepayers. A range doesn't cut it.
The rate has to be, but within the compensation of the rate, there's an automatically perspective or an inherently prospective accounting involved, so that you're never going to be able to know precisely what the company is going to be expending, not just for executive compensation, but for lots of things.
Right. You give them a bottom line revenue requirement, and they spend it as they deem appropriate. But executive compensation is an element.
And it actually adjusts the next year to reflect any time that they haven't spent it. If it's underspent or if their debt structure is paid.
They keep the money. They keep the money if it's underspent or overspent. But the FERC has to satisfy itself that the rates are just and reasonable. And if there's a black hole, which we submit there is, in this case, the size of executive compensation, the FERC cannot satisfy that obligation. Now, just to be clear, we're saying that not necessarily the bottom line rate is unjust and unreasonable in this case, but we are saying that the FERC was arbitrary and capricious in the manner in which it considered the evidence, denied us a hearing, and explained its decision, which we think does not address the issues that we raised about the relevancy of the proxy group, the changes in economic circumstances, and the failure to disclose a reasonable range for executive compensation. And for those reasons, we ask that the court remand this case back to FERC for a hearing to properly investigate those issues.
Thank you, counsel. Your time, we've talked you well past your allotted time, but we'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Good
morning, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. Beth Pacella for FERC. Let me start off with just pointing you out to JA 284 to 92, which is where the answer provided specifically what the executive's 2008 compensation possibly could be completely. So we knew when the commission made this decision that exactly what 2008 pay was. And all of these allegations about using estimated costs being inappropriate, first, was never raised to the commission. And secondly, let me just tell you, it's completely appropriate. That's how you do, as I explained in my brief, that's how revenue requirements are done. You have to do an estimate because you don't know exactly what your costs are going to be during the year to come. So a very typical thing to do is you use, for 2009, the 2008 figures, and that's exactly what occurred here. Let me point out as well that the Mercer report, it aged the data from 2000, whatever was used from 2007, that data was aged. And that's explained to JA 265 to 299. So those were current numbers. Everybody understands, again, when you're doing an analysis in 2008, that you're going to have maybe older numbers. And that's just, again, how it's done and appropriately done. Let me point out as well, which is really a side point, I've never heard this claim before, but let me point out there's a whole true-up process here. So if the executive compensation, if the total revenue requirement is not used, there's a true up and money does go back. It's added into, it's deducted from next year's revenue requirement. So there's no, they just get to keep the money. This is a nonprofit entity. It doesn't get to keep anything. Whatever it takes in, it spends.
It goes in with the next accounting. Right. It's round robin.
That's exactly right.
I understood Mr. Wertheimer to say that initially, when this was first filed, it didn't include executive compensation at all. Is that correct?
By the time the commission looked at this case and made its decision, all of that information was
at the time of your decision, but I'm asking about the initial filing.
The specific details regarding the exact compensation were not in there. The numbers globally about what compensation would be were already included in the filing. And then in response to Connecticut's protest, the ISO came in and gave a very long and detailed answer, giving all of the details about the entire process.
That included the Mercer report.
That included the Mercer report.
Which does give the exact figures.
That's
in
exactly
the pages
right.
of the JA to which you referenced.
That's right, Your Honor.
I think it has a flaw in it because it doesn't anywhere say you add three zeros to each of those numbers, but I'm assuming.
The charts do. The charts do explain that. If not there, if you look at all the little charts at the top, it explains that it's in millions or something, or whatever, thousands. Yeah, thank you.
It's in millions, but that'd be a different case.
You're right, it would be a different case, and then we would have a problem.
It would have a much stronger case.
So I've talked about estimated costs. The Mercer explained very plainly, as did Janice Dixon's affidavit, the Vice President for Human Resources, explained why the proxy group includes the companies that it did. It explains that, again, the revenues are $150 million, but the $12 billion in settlements also exists, and one was too small, one was too big. So they really, what Mercer did was very specifically determine to use companies that for utilities that were had median revenues of $3 billion, and to use for general industry organizations, they use revenues for $1 billion for some circumstances and for $5 billion for other circumstances. They also explained in the Mercer report that on top of that, for certain positions, one position they made an adjustment up because the particular executive's job was more complicated than in most other organizations. And for another executive, they made an adjustment down because this particular person's job was less complicated than it would be in other organizations. So this wasn't just not thinking about it. I mean, it was very detailed and very specific.
What about one interesting strand of Mr. Wertheimer's argument is that the world changed in September of 2008, yet FERC didn't catch up with that in terms of approving this?
This is really, and again, he did cite the correct paragraph. It's at JA 470 in paragraph 22. And what the commission said, the compensation package was based on facts as they existed when it proposed its budget and submitted it for stakeholder approval. It has to be done that way. I mean, if this were a situation where maybe world catastrophe, then you'd have to change that. Maybe you'd have to say, okay, executives aren't making anything anymore, and so how can you justify paying that? But this is how rate-making works.
Outside the context of this case, has FERC taken any different view?
Well, what the commission said in that paragraph as well is when ISO New England files seeking approval for compensation again, it may use any new benchmarks that have arisen. So it understood you do have to consider the changing world, but there's
my question was whether FERC has taken a different approach in any other cases since September of 2008, putting tighter limits on what's appropriate for executive compensation, or do you not know?
I don't know, other than that FERC indicated here in paragraph 22 that it would be considering that. And again, you need stakeholder process, and so you have to use circumstances they were, unless there were an exceptional circumstance, and this really doesn't rise to that, at least not in FERC's view.
Council didn't really get to this, but one of the arguments that Connecticut makes is that they didn't have time after ISO's submission to respond to that because FERC simply accepted it on the day that it issued its decision, essentially.
That's right, Your Honor. That is their claim. But again, remember that due process just requires the opportunity to respond, and what Connecticut did was sit on its hands during those 3 weeks and not file anything with the commission, which absolutely was open to them. They knew that in the commission often grants motions to provide answers to answers, and if they think that they thought they didn't have enough time, all they had to do was ask that. And I have, I just quickly looked up an example of a case in which that occurred, which of course I didn't cite it in my brief, but if you're interested in knowing that this just does happen at FERC, it's Florida Gas Transmission Company, 115 FERC, paragraph 61-182, where the circumstances were almost identical, that a protest was filed, an answer to a protest was filed, responding to those matters, and the Florida Municipal came in and said, we don't have enough, we might be fine with this answer, but we don't have enough time to respond to it, and the commission gave an extra 20 days. They said, we're not going to make a decision on this rate filing at this until we have, people have an opportunity to really consider it. That would have been a very simple thing for them to do, and as this court, you know, has found, for example, in National Fuel, that the petitioner could have tried to raise its new concern, you know, its new concern in the period before the commission considered the matter. And that time was there. And if it wasn't enough, they should have told the commission that. On top of that, they had the opportunity on rehearing. And all they've raised on rehearing was, you know, in our view, these companies are too big because the revenues are different. And, you know, these entities, the ISO is not as risky. Well, the Mercer report explains that these are the entities that the ISO competes for executive talent. So how do you not consider these companies? These are the exact types of companies that the ISO would lose executives to and get executives from. And the only way it can keep those executives or even get them in the first place is to pay comparable compensation. And that's what the commission found happened here, relying on the Mercer report. There's nothing further.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I can just touch on a few points. First, counselors for the FERC spoke about the Mercer report and how the Mercer report and the information submitted in ISO New England's answer provided enough information. First, as you know, we dispute the reliability of that information, but the crux of our argument is that FERC has an independent obligation, not ISO New England, but FERC must determine that the rates are just and reasonable. If it had gone through the Mercer report and its decision explained what it looked at, why it did so, and why it thought the proxy group was okay, that would have been an entirely different situation. But it, in its decision on rehearing, dedicated four paragraphs to the substance of our argument, one of which is goes to the proxy group, and all it said is that we're not convinced that it's not just and reasonable. And to us, that is not sufficiently reasonable and reasoned analysis that goes to addressing the issues we raised in our claim. With respect to Judge Kavanaugh's question about economic conditions, Counselor kind of soft-pedals the magnitude of the economic change. This is the largest recession, the biggest economic downturn since 1929. CEOs of large corporations, including Ford and GM, agreed to take $1 in executive compensation. It did change the world, and it was worthy of...
But that is not answering the question as to when FERC should begin to apply a reaction to that change. Now, it does appear that they were foreshadowing changes in those matters which might come before them after the crash. This matter was already pending, and you really think it's likely we're going to create a precedent that says all the executive agencies have to reconsider everything that's pending in light of economic change?
Your Honor, I think
this is not the only rate maker we have to review.
Understood, Your Honor, but I think it would be reasonable that if the economic change occurred before ISO New England submitted its application to FERC, and I think that would be a very reasonable view that the rates reflected in your application should reflect economic conditions at the time of your application. Not a year or 2 years before, which is what happened here. With respect to your question about whether we had time to answer, I would just urge the court to look at the timeline in this case. Application filed October 31st. Our protest, the answer with a Mercer report filed December 8th. FERC's initial decision 3 weeks later on December 31st. Rates go into effect January 1st.
Did you ever seek the right to file a further plea?
We filed the request for rehearing.
Did you ever seek the right to file a further pleading? You seem to
the
be...
The answers are expressly by rule
I know this.
Prohibited.
That's not answering the question I asked.
We did not file an answer.
That's a yes or no question.
We did not file an answer because
right.
we
no
followed the rule.
No is the answer. Right.
Correct.
Okay.
We did not.
Your time is completed, I think, unless my colleagues have further questions. Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.